If we don't have self-compassion, it's really difficult to cultivate self-love. If we don't allow ourselves to be learners, to make mistakes, to get it wrong sometimes, and have a practice of forgiveness, it's really difficult to love ourselves.
This is Running for Real, the podcast for runners who know that for every runner's high, there are just as many lows. All those just missed PRs, easy runs that feel hard, injury blues, and more. Each week, we'll talk to running, health, and wellness experts about their highs, lows, and best advice to build our confidence. Running for Real is about being honest, being brave, and most of all, not feeling alone. And now here's our host, who loves to run on Wissahickon Trail, Tina Muir.
Hello, my friends. Welcome to 2019 and the 95th episode of Running for Real. We are closing in on 100 really fast, and I'm trying to set up something extra special to celebrate that very soon. Now, I wanted to start off this year with a good positive note, and where better is to start than working on our own self-image? You know, the way we treat ourselves. In the past, it hasn't been cool to work on yourself. You need to grind, push harder, try harder, do more. But I kind of feel like a change is coming. We're realizing the importance of actually stepping back and working on doing the best for ourselves, which, yes, sometimes does involve downtime. Although I have to admit, I struggle with that too. Before we get further into that, the last episode of 2018 was a recap episode about your favorite episodes of 2018. I asked you to tell me which ones you loved and which parts were your favorite out of those episodes. I compiled them up into a list of best episodes, and thank you to those of you who suggested your episodes. If you had not heard any of the episodes mentioned last week, I hope you went back to check them out. And if you are a newer listener, maybe that is a good episode for you to go listen to know kind of which episodes to go for next. Now, today we have Dr. Melody Moore on the show. Melody is a psychologist who's going to help us start this year off right by believing in ourselves like we absolutely deserve to. We're going to see what our strengths are, learn how to be present, and what the heck that even means, and so much more. We talk body image, we talk about how we have this need to always be doing, or is that just me? And we talk about our inability to celebrate our successes, something that runners are notorious for. I have a few surprises for you coming in this episode, so see if you can notice what changed. You are going to absolutely love Melody, so let's go meet her. My friends, my first ever book is out in just over 2 weeks. Overcoming Amenorrhea, Get Your Period Back, Get Your Life Back is going to be out in the world on January 21st. And if you want to show your appreciation for these podcasts and all that I do to help others, I hope you will pre-order a copy. You can do that at tinamuir.com/pre-order. Melody, thank you so much for joining me today on this first episode of 2019. I am really excited for everyone to learn from you and just kind of get soaked in with everything that you talked about, because it's just so wonderful. So thanks so much for being here.
Absolutely. I'm thrilled to be here. Thank you for asking me to be, especially your first guest of this year.
I know. How exciting and how weird that it is 2019. We're almost in the 2020s, which is just so strange to think about. But yeah, I'm excited for this. And I thought this would be a good episode to have you on as the first one, so we could get off on the right note for this year, because we all start off with good intentions in our year and kind of fall off the bandwagon. So I'm hoping this can be one people can go back to time and time again, particularly because this is something that we tend to go in waves with, how we feel about being positive body image or body image in general. We tend to go through ebbs and flows of how we feel about ourselves. So why is it important, first off, to, you know, talk about body image and kind of spin our perspective if we don't feel good about ourselves? Why can we not just carry on as we are? What does it matter if we don't like our bodies?
I think it's imperative that we find an acceptance for our bodies and maybe are able eventually to transcend the body in a way that I think it's impossible to bypass to that point of enlightenment without finding a true acceptance of our body as it is. And the reason for that is because without that acceptance, we are stuck in giving our very limited amount of time and energy and effort to being critical and judgmental and negative towards ourselves. which takes us away from being curious about the things that we might be able to contribute to in the world, or being curious about how to be present in a moment of connection with someone or something or place that we are in front of or could be experiencing. You know, like thinking about struggling with negative body image thoughts and internal critiques and judgments about the way somebody looks, you know, if a person is feeling like, I can't be in a bathing suit, I can't be in a swimsuit, they miss the whole activity of being able to like take in the sunshine and the ocean and the experience of being there with their beloved, because they're feeling so insecure about how they look instead of actually being able to experience in that moment. And if you extrapolate that into a lifetime, like having negative body image then can distract from an entire life. It's like a way of distraction and falling asleep from an entire sense of purpose and of belonging.
And I think it kind of makes me think that, you know, like if you had an argument with a loved one right before you were about to, I don't know, go snorkeling, and you had an argument, you probably wouldn't be enjoying it as much because you're like, oh, I wish I'd said this, or, oh, that's so annoying, or how dare they say that? So it's the same kind of thing of what you just talked about there, that when we have this negativity surrounding us, it's, we're never going to be able to, like you said, be present. And I'd love for you to explain before we go on any further, what do you mean by present? You know, for someone listening who hears this word being thrown around, what does that mean to be present?
Yeah, to me, it means being fully awake to the experience, being able to take in, to drink in, to digest what's happening in the here and now, in this very moment. Like, so presence sort of obviously means timing wise, the here and now. So not stuck in the past, not worried about the future, but right here and right now in this very experience. And the only thing that's real right now is I'm sitting here talking to you. Mm-hmm. That's it. That's all that's happening. Even though lots of things are going on in the world, they're not happening to me. And so if I can be, to me, the layers of presence also entail being present in my body. I have to know if my voice is shaking, if I feel anxious in my belly, if I feel angry or annoyed, by being able to link sensation in my body with emotional experience to inform me about how am I right now? How am I feeling? How am I experiencing you? How am I experiencing myself in this moment all the time? So it's actually a lot of work and a tremendous amount of effort to stay present.
And what about for someone listening who is thinking, okay, well, that sounds all well and good, but, you know, I don't have the time to just kind of focus on one thing at a time. You know, I have to be thinking about what I'm going to make my kids for lunch tomorrow while I'm doing the vacuuming. I can't afford to just focus on one thing at a time. I need to be doing multiple.
Well, I would invite a person to consider that that's actually an illusion. But what happens when we become present is we feel less need to fill in and get busy and overdo and overwhelm ourselves with all of the doing. And so counterintuitively, when we can slow down and do one thing at a time, we end up doing it really well. We end up doing it in a way that can bring us joy, instead of just like sloughing through and feeling like everything is spinning all at the same time. So I really am being reality based, even though it may not seem like it, when I say, like, if you're vacuuming, notice what it might feel like to just vacuum, like just to watch the completion of lines being made in the carpet for that moment. And when your mind wanders, drawing it back to like right here, can I breathe and do this motion? You might have a very different experience of vacuuming. And when you're making the lunch for your children tomorrow, doing just that, you probably would do both things in 10 minutes combined or 5 minutes each. I really don't think it's a matter of, but then you won't ever get anything done if you're mindful. Same thing with eating. If you're mindful when you're eating the food, if you're present to the experience that you're having.
Yeah. And do you, I'm sure you see this in our kind of society now, it is about more, you know, the busier you are, the more successful you will be, the more things you can kind of say that you've done, the better. And I am more guilty than anyone of going through this at times. And I'm absolutely positive that's why I've struggled with insomnia at times, because of that exact reason. So for someone listening who is kind of feeling like I see what you're saying, but I want to pressure, I feel a pressure to do something. Maybe I'll be happy when I accomplish this, or maybe I can try this once I get through this busy period of my life. What would you say?
It reminds me of when Dr. Phil used to be on Oprah, and he would say, well, how's that working for you? Which is really my style. But that comes to mind, just giving the question back of like, is it working? Mm-hmm. In my experience, in my own life, whenever I set up an if then, or when then, when I achieve this goal, when I make this much money, when I get this label or this identification, or I'm invited to be a part of this elite group of whatever kind, then I'll have this experience. And that's not actually ever the case. I think we can spend our entire life chasing the happiness.
Absolutely.
Or stop and let go of the clinging to the outcome that we associate with bringing the happiness and just be.
Yes.
And instead recognize like this may be the only moment we have. So what may already be here that we can find contentment with. Like, yeah. This is enough.
Absolutely. And I think this is what you're just saying there is so imperative to runners, because I know you have, you know, spoken to runners in the past. I know you know Lauren Fleshman well, and she may have told you some about this, but as runners, we tend to, you know, basically cross the finish line of one race and already thinking about what we can do next, never really kind of soaking in the moment of what we've done. If you've had a bad race, it's, oh, I need to redeem myself. If you've had a good race, it's, well, if I did this now, then what can I do in a year? So what would you say, you know, to people who do kind of find themselves getting in a cycle of never really appreciating the moments? Would there be any further advice you'd have, maybe more targeted towards runners or just people who tend to get caught up in it?
I would consider thinking about sustainability. And this is something Lauren and I have talked about too, and I'm sure you think about a lot, is what about the joy of running? Like remembering what motivated you to begin mm-hmm. this sport. Why are you attracted to it? Is there something beyond the outcomes and something in the moment to moment, breath to breath, foot in front of foot experience that offers you some kind of fulfillment? Just in that, like if there were no times, if there were no wins or losses or PRs, all the things, like, could there just be something about the experience that you're having that you could cherish, that is seen by you and felt by you as something to treasure? And that's even felt by you as like an offering that you give yourself. I let myself run. Yes. And give myself this opportunity to be out here amongst nature, amongst friends, doing this thing that I just enjoy doing. Uh-huh. I think in the absence of that balance, it's easy to become overwhelmed by the outcomes, like you're saying, the numbers and the times and the titles, and totally lose. I think the risk is really high to completely lose the joy.
Absolutely. And I don't know how much you know about my story, Melody, but when I was an elite runner and I stopped running to start a family, one of the primary reasons I've talked about why that was because I was, all that was keeping me going was the finish line. I was in January and I was like, okay, well, I've just got to get to July because that's when the race is. And then I can cross the finish line and then I can be happy. Like, and then I can be proud and get that thrill, that buzz. And it just, like you said, sucked all the joy out of the running. Every day was just getting through. And now fast forward a few years, coming back to my running, I've talked a lot about lately that I have been racing. I have been doing well, not maybe as well as I was before, but close enough. But I've also been just running for the joy, standing on the start line saying, my only goal is to enjoy myself. And it's just a whole new level of just fulfillment that I hadn't experienced. I had in the past, but I'd lost it. Like you said, it's not sustainable. So on that note, people listening, you know, I know we've kind of already talked about this in a different context, but for someone listening saying, okay, well, I'll do that running for joy thing once I get my Boston qualifier, or once I get this goal, then I'll kind of run for joy. But first I have to get there. So actually, let me just add to that. So Boston is a good example. If someone gets a Boston qualifier, then they'll say, well, when I'm in Boston, I'll enjoy my race. Any thoughts on that?
I would imagine your experience would tell you otherwise, that that's just not the case. Mm-hmm. It's just always a setup. It's like a mind loop we put ourselves on without an opportunity for an exit. There is no exit strategy there because it's still an if then, it's still a when then instead of a here now.
Yeah.
And the antidote is the here now, the recognition of like the only time to enjoy this moment is right now. And so if I run past it, I'll miss it. I can't go back and have previously enjoyed that thing I didn't enjoy because I was waiting for this. So the greatest predictor of future beingness, future behavior is always past behavior, right? So if you're not enjoying the training for the Boston Marathon or the qualifying for it and you get there, the likelihood that at that moment you're going to switch off in the hype and in the excitement of being at that marathon, switch off and suddenly enjoy running is extremely low. It's like statistically, there's no way that then you're going to enjoy that race.
But what about the high of, I agree with you, but I'm just kind of, I'm being devil's advocate with people as I know I've been in this way of thinking. I know I'll enjoy it because I've worked hard and it will mean so much to me because I've overcome a lot and, you know, getting to Boston has been my lifetime goal. So I know I'm going to enjoy it because I've worked to get there. Anything else to add?
To me, I'm not very confrontive, so I might be like, okay.
Good for you.
Good luck. Yeah, good luck. It's a worthy investigation, right? I think for each of us, it's a worthy investigation. I think at any time we're actually ready to see things differently. It's because we've had to suffer enough to recognize, oh, this just can't be it. This can't be the way. I'm too uncomfortable in my current methodology of thinking. I'm seeking a solution. I want to see another path. So I think for somebody who's like deeply committed to like, I will not enjoy this. Okay. I'm not going to take that away from you. If you're committed to not enjoying until you enjoy, go ahead. But at some point, I think each of us do find regarding whatever passion or whatever interest or hobby or work, a relationship, we do come to a place of this isn't working for me. Mm-hmm. The cost has just become too high. My self-integrity is lost. Or my care for the sport is waning. This doesn't feel sustainable. And I think it's at that place when we're ready to be open to like, maybe there's an opportunity for me to see this differently, to have a different relationship to it.
Yeah. Okay, great. Thank you so much for explaining that. And sorry to kind of keep coming at it at different angles. I know how people can think and I've been there and I just wanted to make sure we kind of addressed all the yeah, buts that might come up. So let's kind of switch gears here and talk about, you know, self-love, self-appreciation. In your work, what you do, would you say the biggest thing you see people struggling with when it comes to self-love?
I feel like it's giving away self-approval. Mm. It's giving away self-approval. It's like the inability to harness one's own enoughness and instead break themselves off into pieces and offer the pieces out to the time of my race, my coach's approval, my peer's approval, my partner's parents' approval, instead of if this comes from me, I feel in this moment, this joy, this presence, this capacity to just be awake to the experience that I'm having, and that is enough. So I feel like it's often not that people aren't born with enough self-love. It's that throughout the journey of life, we've put on top of what was a sense of self-acceptance, all kinds of rigidity and rules and criticism and conditions that then begin to limit and chip away at our self-love because we give those parts out. Mm-hmm. Give it to other people. We give it to ideals, perfectionism. We give it to circumstances that we think, I think I should be that. I was that. I loved hearing you say, I'm not running as fast as I once was, but I'm running fast enough, right? That's like a message of self-approval to mm-hmm. me, of self-love mm-hmm. to me. I don't have to do that today because I did that then. It may even be better later. Who knows? But so I think that's a big piece of self-love. And I think another piece I see often, and certainly has been true in my own journey, is if we don't have self-compassion, it's really difficult to cultivate self-love. If we don't allow ourselves to be learners, to make mistakes, to get it wrong sometimes, and have a practice of forgiveness and grace toward ourselves, it's really difficult to love ourselves because if we identify with things that we've done that we're not proud of or we don't approve of, then we create shame. And Brené Brown's done enough work for all of us you know, to tell us like, okay, well, that shame is going to become the black tar over the capacity to fall in love with oneself.
Absolutely. And for someone listening who thinks, okay, maybe this could be me, what are some behaviors of someone who isn't giving themselves enough self-love, self-compassion? What might be some things? Is it kind of overthinking things, sitting, you know, like I said about the argument earlier, going over it out for hours and hours? What are some traits you might see?
Yeah. One thing is the inability to set boundaries. So the inability to know that I start and stop here and you start and stop over there. So I have this boundary, this like sort of screen door that's up between you and I, whoever the you is, right? The partner, the kid, the parent, the coach, the coworker, whatever. And so I have an ability to say no, no to request, no to having to show up to meet your needs, no to working extra hours, no to doing everything while you do nothing, whatever it is. Like the capacity to say no allows, it's just so imperative for self-love, because I think when we can't say no, we don't develop a healthy yes. And then we get ourselves into places of feeling really resentful, mm-hmm. Towards others and towards ourselves. So big thing to me is boundary setting. Another thing is integrity, being able to line up how we think with what we feel, with what we say, with what we do. And if we become people who set a goal, but then don't do the goal, I'm going to get up every morning this week and I'm going to run at least 2 miles or whatever it might be. Hopefully it's not every day. I think there should be breaks, right?
No, a lot of people I would imagine listening are, I used to run 7 days a week, but obviously that's a different level, but I imagine a lot of people are. Anyway, keep going.
Every day. All right. I'm going to stick with my running schedule and I'm going to run I'm going to run every single day, or I'm going to start meditating. I'm going to meditate daily, or I'm going to gain or lose weight, depending on goal orientation there or whatever. If you find that you're constantly setting goals for yourself and then not able to meet them, and that you let yourself down and feel really disappointed, like you've gotten it wrong, and then you go into self-beat, so then you avoid the goal altogether, maybe put it off for another week or month or years. Like, I'm going to write a book. So I'm going to start, I'm going to write 5 minutes a day, and then you don't do it. You get so mad at yourself, and then you don't even approach the right. So letting oneself down and breaking one's self-trust creates, again, just a sense of guilt that doesn't allow for self-love. It's kind of like breaking boundaries is generally between you and other people, but it's really with yourself. And breaking trust with yourself is another thing. I think we find ways to self-sabotage. So it makes it really difficult to find love for self.
Yeah, no, that's good that you explained that. And I think a lot of people listening will be people, well, we all struggle with it from time to time, but hopefully will be a bit of a kind of wake up call that it is something that you need to do. And just going further into that, you know, others may compliment us on our achievements, our accomplishments, things we've done. But we kind of see it as, oh, that was no big deal. And there's almost kind of a sense in our society that you don't want to come across as too self-compassionate, too loving to yourself, because it comes across as arrogance. So where do you find the balance there between, you know, self-love and not kind of taking it to the point of to where it might put people off, or maybe just you feel uncomfortable because you know that, you know, that's not how you were raised, or that's not what makes you feel, I don't know, confident, or makes you feel too confident in who you are?
Yeah. I mean, to me, I think it's a little bit of a systemic issue. Mm-hmm. And I have to look at where my relationship to that systemic issue. So to me, it's an issue of white supremacy, and it's an issue of misogyny that mm-hmm. as a woman, I would feel like I was bragging to be confident and to say, I am good at public speaking, or I'm a decent writer, or if I were a runner, you know, I'm a decent runner. I don't know how I define that, because I don't, unless there's a bear chasing me, I'm very likely not to be running.
But you say that, I think I guarantee you everyone listening will justify themselves pretty much in the same way of, you know, everyone always says, whenever I meet anyone, they say to me, I'm just a back of the pack. I'm just like justifying why they're not as good as me, or why they're not like in my realm, even though I see everyone the same. So I think you saying that is good to hear, because everyone does that, kind of downplays what they have done. So sorry, continue with what you're saying.
Yeah. Yeah. No, I mean, I literally am not a runner. Not a back of the pack runner, like not at all a runner. I went on one run this year though, because I was at Wazelle Camp.
Yep.
And I was like, I'm into it. I got some free Salomon shoes.
Yeah.
And I did a run, which I was very proud of. But anyway, I feel like the reason most of us cannot own our strengths is how I think about it, is because we've been taught, especially women have been taught. And if you do so, you'll be ostracized. Like you're saying, you'll be seen as arrogant. And so we have bought that message. We've bought into it. And we feel as though we don't want other people to feel badly about themselves. So we don't want people to feel angry or annoyed at our narcissism. And so I'm not going to just own my strengths. And I actually feel like it's an act of rebellion against misogyny to, as a woman, say, I'm a strong runner, if that were the case. You know, I'm a fast runner. I'm an elite athlete, if that were true of me. For me to say, I'm a good yoga teacher, or I'm great at public speaking, or I'm a decent writer, or you know, something I can identify as being, I think I'm a great therapist. And so I don't say that. And I have to say that and also feel like other therapists or other yoga teachers or other public speakers will feel better about owning their strength because I own mine. Not, I can't say it if I feel like other people are going to feel worse about themselves.
So what about further the other way, where if someone says, I can't say it because what if they're better than me and I'm saying I'm good and now I look stupid because, you know, someone's saying, I said I'm a fast runner because I run a marathon in 4 hours, or I'm a decent runner because I've run in 4 hours, but that person's run 3 hours and they said they were, well, okay. Now I feel like... What would you say there?
Yeah, I would say the person who ran it in 3 hours that's saying they're okay, I wish they would own that they were fast. Mm. It would give permission for the 4 hour runner to also feel proud about their accomplishment. Mm. And that's, I think there's this, Marianne Williamson, who's a friend of mine. She has this quote where she says, our greatest fear is not that we are inadequate. It is that we are powerful beyond measure. It is our light, not our darkness, that most frightens us.
I love that.
Who am I not to be powerful, brilliant, fabulous? Right? Right. Because when we allow ourselves to shine, we give other people permission to do the same. Yes. And so I think we've gotten that wrong. We're, like you just said, we're afraid if I say I'm good, then somebody better than me is going to look at me like, who do you think you are?
Yes.
That's not actually what happens, right? As an elite runner, if you see a runner who's half your speed, say, I'm a good runner, you probably don't feel like, what are you thinking? I could...
Yeah.
You're probably thinking like, good for you. I'm so glad that you can own that.
Exactly.
Right? Like, yay you. Because when you own your capacity, when you know and feel confident in your strength about something, it doesn't intimidate you that somebody else feels proud of themselves. It's more like you can celebrate them because you're not coming from a place of lack or coming from a place of not enoughness, where that you're in a competition or you're in approving. You're more like, oh, great. I want to uplift you. And it's so wonderful that you feel good about your capacity. It doesn't threaten me. It makes me feel even better about my own capacity. Yeah. Yay.
I love that. And I think that's something that everyone listening, you can kind of take that in and really think about it. Think about the way that you word things. Think about it the next time that you say something like that. Catch yourself and kind of retract that statement. Say, you know what? Actually, I am proud of what I can do. So hopefully that will get you to think. And you mentioned gender there. You know, you mentioned women. Is this kind of struggle with self-love or struggle with compassion towards ourselves, is that just women, or what do you see with the two genders?
I think men also definitely struggle with self-love and with enoughness. I think it shows up differently. Mm. I don't think men have, generally speaking, broad stroke generalization. Men don't have as much difficulty claiming their strengths. Mm. You look at men and women in job interviews in a corporate environment, a man is much more likely to be able to, without apology or justification, own, these are my accomplishments in my last job. And woman's more likely to downplay it and honor her boss or her colleagues or her peers, or not name all of the things and the achievements and accomplishments. And it's like, come on, girls. Yeah. Like, say the thing, you did this, be proud of it.
I think that's
a big difference in gender. Yeah,
I think, okay, that's good to know. But also good that you did mention that men do struggle, because, you know, I'm sure there are some people listening thinking, hey, you know, I do too.
Yeah, totally. And really not, you know, men aren't really given permission as much. Boys are not given permission to develop an emotional vocabulary, to be seen in their vulnerability. So of course, like generally speaking, that's really difficult, because not only are they struggling with self-acceptance and enoughness, but there's not a safe place for them to be able to talk about it and not feel as though they're emasculating themselves somehow.
Yeah. And what about with going into that further, body image, body dysmorphia, you know, struggling with the way that you look? You know, many of us do struggle with that, maybe seeing something different in the mirror, or we think we do, than what is actually out there. What are the differences you see there between men and women? Do you, you know, we've kind of always had the focus on eating disorders and struggles with body image be women, but there are a lot of men that kind of deal with it too. So what have you found with the genders when it comes to body image and body dysmorphia?
I work a lot more with girls and women. I think they're more attracted to my work and the way I think and feel. So I know more about people who identify as female. With men, what my understanding is, and again, I wouldn't call myself an expert on men with eating disorders, but you're right that the percentage of people with eating disorders as male is increasing. It used to be 10% 10 years ago, and now sometimes reports are 15, 20% mm-hmm. of those who struggle with eating disorders and negative body image are men. But usually what's occurring for men is they're wanting to be more muscular. They're wanting to be more fit, whereas women tend to want to be more thin. So women see themselves as traditionally bigger than they are with body dysmorphia. I know that's been true for me, whereas men see themselves as smaller perhaps than they are and aren't able to necessarily see like, no, you do have the bulk. You do have, the size that you're looking for, the muscular tonality that you're looking for is in fact already there, but they're seeing themselves as less strong or less fit.
Mm-hmm. And are there any kind of maybe thought patterns or things that people might say to themselves if, you know, if body dysmorphia is kind of going on? I mean, now I can look back on my elite days. I've said this before to my audience many times that I used to always say, oh, I'm a bigger elite runner. And now I look back on my photos and I'm like, why did you ever say that? And I realize how insulting that was to everyone I talked to when I would say that. But it only really clicked into me when my dad hugged me one day and said, Tina, I can feel the bones in your back. And I was like, what? No, you can't. You must be hugging me weird. But like that for me was like a light bulb moment. But for someone who maybe isn't going to have a light bulb moment, what are some thought patterns that maybe they have going on that they can kind of recognize to think, hey, wait a minute, maybe this is something I'm dealing with?
One of the things I think happens with body dysmorphia is we limit the natural curve of range of body size overall. Mm-hmm. So one thing I think runners do is limit their comparison group if they're an elite runner to other elite runners. So now I'm, you know, in your mind, I'm putting myself on the bigger range of people in this tiny percentage of the population. And out of these people who are at this 0.005% of the population, I feel like I'm here on the curve. Mm-hmm. And so one thing that's necessary to do is back way up out of that and have more of a helicopter perspective of all bodies everywhere, runners and non-runners, athletes and non-athletes, people of different cultural backgrounds, ages, heights, and see, I've really narrowed my comparison group, and that narrow-minded perspective of me has caused a lot of negativity that's really unnecessary.
Yeah.
I think negative body image, I think people, we know, you know, when we're being critical of our bodies, looking in the mirror and picking apart parts of our bodies, wishing specific parts of our bodies were different. I won't name them just to not trigger anybody. But it may be that body dysmorphia is present there. Not always, because you could have a realistic perception of yourself and want it to be different. I know for me, earlier this year, I see my girlfriend as being so much thinner than me. I have severe body dysmorphia. Mm. I work on it every day. I see my girlfriend as so much thinner than me, and she had run out to do something and somebody knocked on the door and the only clothes there were the ones like she had just worn, her clothes, not mine. And I'd never put on her clothes before. And so I just put on their like shorts and a tank really fast. And I looked in the mirror and I was like, I cannot believe these clothes fit me. I was shocked. Like I was really shocked. I thought that they were going to be like squeezing tight It's really too small for me. And it would be very obvious to whoever was on the other end of that door, like a package delivery person or something. And I was like, wow, my body dysmorphia is up because I had no idea. We're actually the same size. We're not the same body shape, but I'm actually not as, in my mind, I was like 20, 30 pounds heavier than her. It's not the case.
I think that's good for the people to hear you saying that as well. So showing that even though this is what you do and you're considered the expert, it's still something that you are working through and probably will never get to the end of the line where you don't ever have to deal with it again. I think that's good for people to hear because, you know, it's very easy for us to look at experts, look at people who do something of a certain career path and think, oh, they've got it all figured out. And you mentioned Brené Brown. I love that she always is kind of like, hey, I haven't got this all figured out. And she's the queen of vulnerability. And she yes. still talks about her struggles with it and everything like that. So thank you for sharing that and being honest there. I know people will appreciate that. Let's talk about social media. You know, how does social media come into this with the way that we see ourselves? You know, everything that we've talked about so far, do you see it as something damaging? Do you see it as something good and positive? And how can we make the most of it?
Yeah, it's a double-edged sword, right? Because for me, I see it as both. Our relationship to it is probably like our relationship to everything else. Like you could use running to be really damaging to you. I've worked with patients with anorexia who use running to fuel their disorder. And there are people who use running to like find the greatest joy and the most friendship and like the most fun and a sense of accomplishment in their life. And it's like, how do you relate to running? I feel social media is just like that. Can we have limits around it where it doesn't take us out of our actual life? I think that's like an important boundary to have with social media. Mm-hmm. Can we represent ourselves in a way that's authentic? And can we not get so attached to the outcome of how people respond to what we present on social media? Can we really watch the way that we're thinking and feeling when we're consuming social media? Like if scrolling through somebody's feed is making me feel worse and worse and worse about myself, and maybe it's a good idea for me to not look at this person's feed because I'm not able to have the relationship with that particular feed that is self-nourishing. And so I really think it's both. You know, I think that when other people's images are filtered and the presenter of the social media has ingested the capitalistic, consumeristic model of I have to be a particular, I have to fit into the beauty myth, essentially, that Naomi Wolf talks about. I have to look a particular way in order to even show this image. Mm-hmm. And it makes it really hard for consumers to negotiate their own relationship with that person. People I love to see and to follow on social media are the ones that are just being really authentic. And I have a friend, Hala, who's a wonderful yoga teacher, and she'll post like, this is my yoga practice today. And she's got like a toddler in a diaper and then like a kid who's like making a big mess on the floor. And she's in the middle in like mom clothes, not Lululemon yoga clothes, you know, doing like a forward fold with her head down. Like, this is it. This is what I got. This is what I'm working with. It's me, Legos and a dirty diaper and a, you know, here's this. It's not like gorgeous on a, you know, with a sunset and the sand and a gorgeous yoga mat and a bikini. That's not reality. So
would you say if someone, you know, to maybe kind of go through a filtering of your social media, this is a good time at the beginning of the year. Maybe, you know, as you see accounts come up over the coming weeks, if someone makes you feel good about who you are, if someone makes you feel inspired or excited to do something, then continue to follow them. And if not, either unfollow or mute them so that you can't see it. It doesn't come up in front of you. Is that a good idea to go through and do that?
I think that would be an awesome idea. Mm-hmm. Like what an incredible gift to yourself to be able to filter out that way that if this content is nourishing to me, I'm keeping it. It's kind of like that book, where you touch every object in your house. And if it brings you joy, you keep it. Yes. And if it's the magical art of tidying up, and if you don't, if it doesn't bring you joy, you get rid of it. And then suddenly you're surrounded by only things that bring you joy. So how could you not be joyful in your space? Mm-hmm. How great to modify that around social media, like you're saying, and for the beginning of the year, really go through your feed and see, okay, like you just said, Tina, like, does consuming this person's messaging make me feel better or worse about myself? And no neutral. If it's not better, it's gone.
Yeah. Yeah. And that's exactly what Marie Kondo says, isn't it? If it's got to be joy or get rid of it. So
yeah.
Thank you. Do you ever feel like you're kind of going uphill with what you're trying to teach when, you know, the rest of our society is saying you need to do more, you need to be thinner, you need to lose weight, you need to kind of constantly change who you are and be polite and not speak up and things like that. How do you kind of deal with that day after day and not let it bother you?
Yeah. I mean, it's like kind of like what you said in the beginning when you're like, well, what if the person says this? Well, what if they're thinking this? And I was like, oh, then I would just let them think that. Yeah. I think for me, because it is the way that I think and perceive is so different than mainstream thinking. Mm-hmm. I can't be attached to it. Like I can't on my own certainly change all of that. Like what I can do is try to deliver to interested parties, you know, and to folks who are open-minded or open-hearted to seeing a different way, be willing to share what I've learned through like all my years of being in therapy and being on the yoga mat, which for me is probably like running is for you, a place where it's like self-reflective and joy-filled. And just to see it differently. I have great empathy for people who aren't offered another way of thinking than the only way to feel like you are enough is if you buy into what the media presents to you as successful or beautiful or attractive or, and have to stay caught up in that never ending hamster wheel chase. I have great empathy for that because I've been there and it's impossible. There's no winning. And so my hope is just, can I offer exit ramps?
Yep.
Anybody who's willing to hear, can I offer an exit ramp and go, there's like a beautiful other way of seeing yourself and of seeing those around you. That's just so much more peaceful.
Mm-hmm. And for someone who's, you know, we talked a minute ago about how if a social media account is not making you feel good, you know, remove that from your life. But with mainstream media, you can't do that. You know, TV is all around you. Billboards are all around you. There's a bus driving past you that shows, you know, a perfect woman with a perfect skin and everything else. How can we kind of give ourselves a way of blotting that out without, you know, physically just locking ourselves in a room? Is there any suggestions you would have for kind of reminding yourself that isn't real and this is airbrushed and photoshopped and it's all, you know, curated to look the way that it does.
Yeah, you're right. We can't, unless we're in an ashram, ignore that it's there. And in social media feeds, it's coming up too, mm-hmm. you know, Instagram, Facebook, it's all the, and then there's the ad and it takes some discrimination to even notice, oh, that's an ad. It's not another friend because they're getting really crappy.
They're listening to your advice saying to be authentic. So they're trying.
Exactly. Here it all is, like no differentiating reality. Yeah, I think one thing is just education and awareness, to have media literacy, to have an understanding of the roots and the history of the system as it's been set up, of the ways in which we are being played upon, of how it is based on our own insecurity and our own buying into consumerism that these things are even possible. And to know that our mind does not have our brain literally doesn't have the capacity to always, as quickly as the bus passes by or the pop-up ad shows up, to go, that was Photoshopped. She is only 18. And also she had a team of 8 makeup artists and there's lighting. And then there was this image. And then they picked the best out of the 5,000 images they took of her in that pose. You're just sitting here in your pajamas trying to like get your day together. There's no like, so I think it sometimes does take us slowing down and reminding ourselves of, okay, what in context, this is very different. And also, a great resource is Jean Kilbourne. She has a whole series called Killing Us Softly that's free. She spent her entire life studying media literacy and teaching about it. And so I think the more, you know, it's like the more we know, the more we can tell ourselves, then when those images pop up, it's more of an inherent, okay, I got it. Like a mantra within us of, I can just remember that it's not me against her. And that's not, I am not striving to become that image. I'm striving to become more whole.
Yeah. I love that.
year. Yeah,
that's great. And what are your thoughts on apps like Headspace or, you know, things where you do like the 1 minute meditation or the 1 minute body check? I can't remember what exactly it's called. You know, just little bursts of kind of bringing awareness, mindfulness. I know there's a book called Mindful Running by Mackenzie Havey that kind of talks about running mindfully, but just in day-to-day life, if someone doesn't have the time, if you want to say that, or just doesn't have the desire to do a yoga class or some meditation, are these little like bites of it going to do help?
I think so. I don't think they're going to hurt.
Okay.
And they're a start. You know, you may sometimes feel like you don't want to run, but then you put on your tennis shoes and you're like, well, maybe. And then you just walk out the door and then you're like, oh, well, the sun's shining and like maybe. And then maybe you start and like five steps in, you're reminded of like, I could probably run for a yard or I guess I'd be a yard. Or I could probably run for however, a block.
Yeah.
And then by then you're kind of like more warmed up and you're like getting into it. Like maybe I could do 1 mile. And then after a mile, maybe you're like, oh, you know what? Today's more like a 3 mile day for me or whatever it is.
Yeah.
I think it's like that with meditation and with stillness and with slowing down. It's like, we have so much resistance, but it might be the kind of thing, like you set a goal for a minute, you might be surprised one day after doing a minute, I don't know, once or twice a week for a while, like, I don't know what 2 minutes would feel like. Mm-hmm. I mean, it may begin to slowly creep up on increasing without a lot of intention around it. But certainly I think, you know, I think there is an unbelievable amount of gift in stopping and taking 3 deep breaths, which doesn't take a whole minute. It could if your breaths are really deep, but like any time.
Unless you're David Blaine, who can hold his breath for like 17 minutes or whatever it is.
Right? Yeah, but for most of us, right? To stop and take 3 deep breaths, mindful, just following the inhale in through our nose and into our lower diaphragm, letting our abdomen expand, and to breathe out like, oh, there's probably going to be a really big shift in that. Yep. And so if meditating for a minute links up to taking 3 deep breaths, like I think it's a tremendous benefit.
Love that. That's great. Okay. And that's very easy to kind of adopt into our day-to-day lives. Now, just one more thing to wrap up here. I mentioned earlier that you know, Lauren Fleshman well, and I only really discovered this doing the research for having you on this show, but tell us, as you have kind of got to know Lauren, I know she's someone who the running community just absolutely adores. What is it from your perspective that you see that's so special about Lauren?
I adore Lauren. She's one of my dearest friends. She is so authentic. You know, I love, actually, she's a great person to follow on social media.
Yes.
Everybody probably already does. But one of the reasons for that is she seems on social media just like she is, just like I experience her in friendship. And I love that there's not a veil. It's like, here it is. And in fact, that's how she and I became friends. We're both part of an organization called World Muse that's in Bend, where Lauren lives. And I had done the keynote presentation the year before. And then they asked me to come back and interview Lauren. I had never heard of her. I'm not a runner, know who this was. But I looked her up and I was like, I see why they asked me to interview her. She had received a whole lot of comments after a picture of her was posted where she looks like this. It looks like she has the most amazing body. Mm-hmm. And so people were writing comments like, oh, I could never look like you. I'm not going to eat for the next 2 weeks. I'm going to do 1,000 pushups a day so I can have your arms, or whatever the comments were. And she was like, hold on, everyone. No. And she posted, this is what I really look like. That was one of those.
Cellulite, wasn't it? Her leg.
Right. Yeah. Like grabbed cellulite in her thigh. And she showed a picture of like her belly more protruded than it was in this like 6 or 8 pack ab picture. And she just was like, no, don't get it twisted. This is what's real. And so I interviewed her about that and her decision to be authentic in that way. But Lauren is smart. Mm-hmm. She's wicked smart. She's a really good writer and she's a brilliant thinker. She thinks systemically. She's really knowledgeable about the body, about science. But another thing I really love about her, I could actually talk about this for an hour. I love her, is she's committed to uplifting and empowering women. She's committed to being someone who educates herself on white privilege and on social justice issues. She really lives that. And it's throughout her conversations and the way that she lives her life and who she surrounds herself with. So I love that, you know, I call those women girls. like a sister, I've got your back. And she loves to celebrate other people's successes. Talk about someone who's not afraid to own her own strength and like in her presence, like, yeah, and I'm good at this. Mm-hmm. And she can sing and play the guitar.
Yeah. I didn't think I knew about the singing, but that's, well, yet another talent. Amazing.
Yeah. Singing and playing guitar and playing piano and probably other instruments too. So that's the final thing I love about Lauren is she, because her dad told her this, we lost our dads at similar times. I lost my dad right before she did and was luckily able to help walk her through that process of mourning. But one of the things her dad told her was always jump in the water. When you see water, always jump in. Okay. No matter how cold it is. So we've jumped in some really cold lakes together. And I love that, just the willingness to be playful and fun and have that sense of adventure and presence. Like, okay, if not now, when? I'm going for it, even if it's really uncomfortable.
Yeah. Oh, that is great. Thank you so much for just confirming what we all kind of hoped was true. And now we know it. So great to share that with us. Overcoming Amenorrhea is coming out in the world on January 21st, just a few weeks away. I've worked really hard on making it the best it can be, and it's something I'm proud of. Today, we are talking about self-compassion and learning to believe in the beauty we have inside. This book is not just about overcoming amenorrhea, it's also about learning to love who you are. It would mean the world to me if you could purchase a copy, either now through pre-order or the week it comes out. Let's be real, as much as we may have good intentions to remember things like this, sometimes I might note something in my mind and think, sure, I'm going to remember it when the time comes, but somehow I don't. But it is so important to me to make sure as many people purchase it as possible in this pre-order period or in the week it releases. That will help me to get to be the bestseller for my category of the book, which sets me up for life as an author. If you think there's even a tiny chance that you'll forget about it that week because, well, life happens, please consider signing up to my email newsletter and I'll let you know when it's out. I promise my emails are not spammy. They're just weekly check-ins with a thought of something maybe you could be going through, and you'll be amazed how often I'm right with those. A challenge for something to build your confidence and some updates. You can sign up at tinamuir.com/subscriber. Thank you so much for your support, my friend. I will be forever grateful if you get yourself a copy. All right, let's get on with the Running for Real 4. Now, for those listeners, I have changed these for 2019. So Melody is the first person who's going to get to answer these. Starting with, what is one piece of advice you'd like to give the listeners for life?
For life?
Piece of advice for life.
Think about that. They're going to hold on to it their entire lives. It's got to be really solid. The first thing that comes to mind is, there's nothing you need to do to earn forgiveness.
Oh, I love that.
Compassion isn't something we have to earn. It's inherent. Mm. Our enoughness is inherent and available. So if you can let yourself make mistakes and let yourself get it wrong, let yourself identify as human because of that, it opens up the possibility for growth and change and transformation.
Mm. I love that. So, thank you. That is a great one to start off with. All right, next. Now, I'm not going to let you pick Lauren because I am sure most people already do follow her, but give us one person to follow on social media and why.
Follow Carrie Kelly.
Carrie Kelly.
K-E-R-R-I-K-E-L-L-Y. She founded an organization called Citizen Well. And the reason is because she's always looking out and championing the underdog.
Mm, love that.
Her messages are powerful, they're uplifting, they're authentic, but she's always looking for how can I be of service in creating equality and creating justice in the world.
That's great. Perfect. All right. I will have a link in the show notes. All right. Melody, how do you want to be remembered?
It's having loved well.
Oh, that's so cute. Perfect.
Loved well, received love and given love fully.
That is great. All right. And finally, before you're going to give a presentation, I would usually say, what do you tell yourself on the start line of a race? But before you're going to give a presentation, a keynote speech, something like that, what do you tell yourself?
So I have a practice I developed one time that I was really nervous about giving a talk. I have to tell myself that this is not about me. Mm. It's not for me, it's for the listener. And yes. So I lean into the mirror and I look into my own eyes where my soul resides. And there I can't pick apart my body, right? All I can see is these sweet eyes. And I say to myself, no one better than you can deliver what your heart knows. Oh, that's There's nobody else that could say this. There's like no one else in the world that could deliver this talk. I usually don't know what I'm going to say. I don't plan a whole lot. and then I just take a deep breath into that because that is the truth. And then I just try to let my ego get out of the way so that people can have an experience that benefits them, that has nothing to do with what they thought of me. And that makes it a whole lot easier for me to just show up and be authentic, because it's not about being liked or being approved of by others. It's about them feeling better about themselves after we've made a connection.
So good. So good. That is pure gold. Thank you so much. All right, Melody, where can people find out more about you if they want to follow you in the future and kind of learn more about what you do?
Yeah, thanks for asking. DrMelodyMoore.com. It's DR. You'll have a link, but then my name, DrMelodyMoore.com. And then sign up for my mailing list. And I send out newsletters, usually monthly, that say where I'll be teaching, speaking, online courses that I offer, retreats, and more. So great. I'd love for them to find me there and find out more about my organization, which we didn't get to talk about, but which is Embody Love Movement. Yep. At embodylovemovement.org.
And I would definitely encourage people to check that out. I will have links in the show notes. Yeah, we did run out of time, but maybe we can have you on another time to talk about that in the future. Melody, thank you so much for sharing your wisdom, your, you know, kindness, your grace, everything today. It's just been so special, and just what a way to start off the year. So thank you so much.
I love it. Thank you so much, Tina, for all the work that you're doing. And thanks for having me as your guest.
My friends, if you have a minute and you could leave a review on your favorite podcast player, Apple Podcasts, aka iTunes, Stitcher, Overcast, Pocket Cast, Spotify, or whatever else podcast player you use to listen to this podcast, or if you would subscribe to this podcast, you will help me get out in front of new runners to make our tribe even bigger and even better. It might not seem like you as one person can make a difference, but really it helps a lot. And it shows me you appreciate the hard work I put in for those. Thank you so much. Well, what did you think? I know it's pretty spiritual stuff, but as I mentioned in the beginning, I think that's the direction we need to move in. I always thought that doing more was better, but now I'm stepping back and trying to slow down consciously. I am seeing the power in it. Not that I'm not a go-getter anymore, but there's a time and a place to be that way. So give what she's saying a try and see how you feel. Be sure to tag Melody and I in your social media posts about it. It means the world to me when I see that you've tagged me in things or shared on your social media that you enjoyed the episode. So thank you so much to anyone who does that. It really does make me smile every time I see it. Now, my book, Overcoming Amenorrhea, is out in less than 3 weeks, and I would love if you would help support me by purchasing yourself a copy. Now, originally, I thought I was going to tell people to go pre-order, and I have created a pre-launch team who are going to pre-order and read the book and let me know what they thought ahead of time. But actually, I've since found out that buying it ahead of time as a pre-order actually doesn't count towards your sales for bestsellers list on Amazon. So may I ask you a favor and ask that you consider signing up, but then you decide to go to my website instead and be put on the list of where I will email you on the day. So you can sign up to that by going to tinamuir.com/subscriber. That will put you on my email list. And trust me, when I say email list, I'm not going to bombard you with thousands of emails every week about this, that, and everything else. My email list is simply you get an email Monday with a kind of a thought for the week, some updates of what you might have missed, maybe podcast episodes, maybe a blog post, and some kind of challenge for you to do. That is it. I promise you guys, and you probably have heard others talking about my email list because it's nothing scary. But if you sign up for that, I will be letting you know when it is live. I will be reminding you that week, and I hope you will consider purchasing my book then. That will give me a ginormous help, and we all know that Amazon kind of rules the roost in many ways. So if I can get a bestseller book in my category after that first week, it will seriously set me up for life, potentially. Get it for your loved ones, or even just read it so you can know what to look out for in maybe your daughter or your niece or someone that might be dealing with this sometime in the future. And of course, if you're interested in learning more about my story, I go over that in detail. I can't wait to hear what you think, and I hope you'll help me to get it to be a bestseller. Next week, we have Dr. Tom Michaud on the show to talk about feet and how our lower body is the key to almost everything, whether it be staying healthy or getting injured. We need to make sure that our feet and our lower extremities are actually where they should be. Tom is a wonderful person and he's so eloquent. He knows everything about all the research and it's just fascinating listening to him. I know you're not going to be disappointed. So subscribe if you haven't already. Tag me in any posts you want to do. And remember, go to TINAMUIR/subscriber to sign up and I will let you know when my book is ready. Thank you so much. Have a great week.
Thanks for listening to the Running for Real podcast. Be sure to check out TINAMUIR.com for show notes and even more helpful running information.